Now, I want to introduce someone who I think is a major American prose writer, whose work will be published probably later this year by Grove Press. An older fellow who was my early teacher and guru, both in language and in perception, Mr. Herbert Hunke.
I'm afraid that my voice will sound pale next Alan's. He's always so vibrant, you know. Sort of me. As a sort of introduction, I'll read to start with Song of Self. Herbert E. Hunke, my name. Although I'm generally known as Hunke and by a few as Herbert and in the past as Herbie. It is seldom I'm referred to as Mr. Hunke, and when formal introduction is required, it is usually Herbert Hunke. I mention all this concerning my name simply because recently I've grown to dislike my name. Not because my name is Herbert Hunke, but rather because I've reached a point where my name, any name I might have had, by its mere utterance, creates an almost weary and loathsome feeling in me. When I say it to myself, and frequently I say it to myself, I am immediately aware of a sense of disgust as though the sounds I make are significant of not only me, but of a new and strange disease. And I am sure for at least the instant I am at last slipping into an insanity from which there is no escape. For several years, I've been confident I will become insane. In fact, I've felt thusly almost as far back as I'm able to recall. Once, when I thought I would become a writer, I was quite young, 14 at the time, I made periodical attempts to write poetry, and on this particular occasion, I became fully aware of the sense of pending insanity. It was shortly after dawn, and a huge, glistening sun was ascending a delicate blue sky. It was early summer, and people were beginning to enjoy the bright colors of summer attire. I was living on Superior Street, just east of North State Street in Chicago, in an old wood frame house that had been converted into what is called studio apartments. The house was well constructed, and the rooms were large, with high ceilings and windows reaching the full height of each room. I had spent the few hours just preceding daybreak, bathed in moonlight, watching the sky through one of my windows. There were two in this room, huge windows which could be flung up quite high, letting in all the outside, sound and scent and air, on either side of a fireplace with a white mantel, with two large brass candlesticks with tall green candles, allowing my thoughts to dwell as they would, and pondering over my problems and the magnificence of a daybreak. I had sent my minute energy quota into the central urge, aiding each rent in the block of darkness, tugging at each fold of light to make way for the one great power, the sun. And now, as I descended the front steps to the street level, the sun was hurtling and spiraling across a great, huge space of blue. To one side of the steps was a flower bed, sparsely filled with yellow jonquils, and I glanced at them and then toward the sidewalk to observe several young women who were rapidly walking past and talking of their work and of something amusing, as when they had almost reached the corner, they began laughing. Their costumes were charming, and one wore something with large figures of poppy red, which I liked. I was rather frightened and deeply impressed. I stood a long time thinking about it, becoming more convinced each instant I was doomed. Several hours later, when I had finished my breakfast and returned to my apartment, I tried putting into a poem all which I had felt, and I was rather pleased with what I had written, although I can't remember any of it, and the actual writing is long misplaced, along with everything of myself at that time. And it wasn't long after I began traveling and ceased considering Chicago my home. I'm going to try to catch a little of each of the so-called moods, I guess, I've written in from time to time. I think I'll try the park next, since this is one of Alan's favorites. In the park. Morning, early, break of dawn, the sky clear and blue, the sun's rays reaching downward through the leaves and boughs of the trees outside our windows. and bird calls prominent above the occasional voices of the early risers and the sounds from the stirring around of those just awakened. I have just returned from a long morning walk through the streets of the city. I have always enjoyed walking, and much of my life has been spent roving city streets through the hours of darkness. Some of my more welcome memories and recollections have to do with my youth in Chicago and many, many nights spent wandering through the city streets and parks and along the lakefront, finally resting atop a stone piling, perhaps, or on a bench watching the sunrise. I had adventures and strange experiences, frequently meeting and becoming involved with other night people. I learned much about sex and about the vast number of people who make up the so-called less desirable element in our American way of life. Haunted people, lonely people, misfits, outcasts, wanderers, those on the skids, drunkards, deviants of all kinds, hustlers of every description, male and female, old people and young people, and they come from every section of the country. Were I requested to select the strangest, the most unusual, the most vicious, the most dangerous, generally the most outstanding, the saddest, the most frightening, the kindest, the one most in need of love, or the one most apt to give love, I would be completely stymied, and at this point there are many I have forgotten. There is one who stands out from the rest slightly, perhaps because he was my first encounter with someone who was, according to even extreme comparison with what I had been taught, was sane, beyond the limit, and undoubtedly very sick and well along toward maniacal. He was unquestionably an excellent example of just what can happen to a human being in a society geared to greed and power, where the human element is almost entirely ignored except in the matter of lip service to a man as an individual, but remains actively indifferent while spewing forth a constant mounting percentage of the population into the group known as human waste, which is accounted for by recognizing the tragedy as a sociological hazard to be expected in the best of organized society. I was about 14 when I met him, and although I was conscious of his aloneness, it wasn't until considerably many more years were added to my age, I realized with any real degree of compassion the stark horror he himself must have sensed almost constantly regarding his existence. It was toward dusk of a warm late summer day, walking through a somewhat remote section of park, thickly wooded and still and little used by people, out near the lakefront, that I first became aware of him. I had left the path that wound around and through the area and was intending to make a shortcut through the trees and bushes to the edge of the lake. I had just pushed through a heavy clump of bushes into a clearer area when suddenly I saw him standing a bit to one side up near the trunk of a large tree. He was partially facing toward me, and as I rather abruptly halted, mostly because of being surprised by seeing him, he smiled and said, "Hi." I answered, saying, "Hello, you kind of took me by surprise." While answering, I looked at him more carefully, taking in his appearance in detail. He was thin and not much taller than me, with sharp-pointed facial features, and though his thin, rather long mouth carried a smile, his eyes, light blue in color, remained cold and hard. His hair was dark blonde, almost brown, straight and long, and part of it fell to one side of his face, covering his ear. And as I watched, he raised his hand and pushed it back, only to have it again fall down as before. His hands were large with exceedingly long fingers and somehow didn't seem to go with the rest of his appearance. He was wearing a white shirt, somewhat soiled and haphazardly tucked into his black trousers. He wore an old pair of badly scuffed brown shoes. As I began moving, intending to continue on my way, he stepped almost directly in front of me and reached out and took hold of my arm up near the shoulder and partly over the muscle. His long, hard fingers dug into my flesh, and as he applied pressure, I winced with pain. He had taken me almost unaware, and for a moment I was intensely surprised as I have ever been. My entire body seemed suffused with panic. I started to struggle, trying to break away. He exerted more force, and for an instant I thought he's going to kill me. He began speaking to me in a sort of imploring tone, begging me not to get scared. He wasn't going to hurt me, although he could. "See," he said, and he raised one of his hands up toward my face to show me the gleaming blade of a knife. "I won't hurt you. Come on, over this way," he said as he began half pulling me along with him toward some tall bushes. By then, my fear and panic had subsided. Somehow, seeing him up close had helped dispel some of the fear. He was younger than he had first appeared, probably somewhere in his late 20s, and also, he had stirred my curiosity in some fashion. I can't remember all that transpired in the short distance we covered, but I had started talking and had succeeded in establishing a sort of friendly note into the situation so that as we reached the bushes, he removed his hand from my arm, and although he still carried his knife, he seemed less menacing. It was still quite light, and although the whole area was filled with shadows, one could see plainly. We pushed into the bushes, stooping over a bit to avoid being scratched on the face, with me in the lead. There was a clear space in the center, and we stopped. It became obvious to me immediately that he had been there before. Lying on the ground was a black jacket, folded, and a leather briefcase. He told me to sit down, and as I did, he squatted down in front of me for a moment, then sank down to a sitting position on the ground, his legs stretched out in front of him. He was in a position where, although he was in front of me, I was facing his side. He fumbled in his shirt pocket and found a couple of cigarettes, one of which he gave me. Putting his knife down somewhere alongside away from me, his side away from me, he located matches and lighted our cigarettes. He allowed himself to lean back a little and drew deeply on his smoke. We had both been quiet while this had taken place, and I was a bit startled when he threw his cigarette down suddenly and said, "Look at that. Ever seen anything like it?" And he reached down to the fly of his pants, pulled it open, and drew out his cock. It was enormous. "Bet you never saw one that big before," he said as he began slowly masturbating. He was quite right. I had never seen anything even remotely comparable in size or length. And my thought was that he was some kind of freak of nature and that this was some kind of a malformation. "You're a nice kid," he said. "I think you wouldn't laugh at someone who's different just because they are different. Here, put your hand on my cock. Just hold it. Don't move it, but squeeze. Not too hard. Just squeeze. I want you to see some pictures." He reached over and held his cock in my hand, complying with his request. He picked up his briefcase, opened it, and began removing stacks of photographs. He put them down by his side, and then putting the briefcase out of the way, he picked up one of the photographs and showed it to me. It was the picture of a little girl, maybe 7 or 8 years old, completely nude. Looking at it more closely, I saw where pencil marks had been drawn around the small mound of her pussy to look like hair. "Ain't she a little doll?" he said. "Do you think I could stick this into her?" And pushing my hand away, he grabbed his cock in his hand and furiously jerked it for a minute or two, all the time muttering obscene words, half stuttering out statements about how good it would feel, and about it being best and a favor to a girl to get fucked young, and especially with a big cock, because then later, no other cock unless bigger could ever hurt her. He threw down the first picture and began picking up one after another, showing them to me. Most were of children, and many were of children without clothing. In one, there was a little boy and a little girl, and apparently he disliked the idea of the little boy having a penis because he had blotted it out with black ink. There were several of naked women, and he described in detail how thrilled they would be if he were to fuck them. Finally, he returned to the first picture. This, apparently, was his favorite, and he gazed at it almost tenderly. All the time, he had continued playing with himself, and now he reached over and began fumbling with me. The whole experience had been unnerving, and I had an erection, but as he opened my trousers and began playing with me, I grew excited. He looked at my cock closely, making little comments about my never comparing to him, and that I would never have to save some little girl from being hurt. He stopped playing with me, telling me to begin jerking myself so he could watch. And as I began, he applied himself more vigorously to his own masturbation, all the time talking about fucking the little girl. "I got it in her now. Oh, it feels good. It's way up in her belly. I've got my big prick in her little tight cunt. It's in up to the balls. Oh, it's good. I'm going to come in her. I'm getting ready. Oh, I feel it coming. All my hot juices for her. Oh, watch." And with that, he ejaculated over and over again, his whole body shaking and quivering, and as he slackened up, he started weeping. And that's that story. I might as well try one more here. That's I'll read this from Mrs. Linenthal, who asked me to. This is called The Magician. Incidentally, I think I'll start by making a little comment. All of the things I've ever written have always been about myself. I can't imagine anyone being in doubt about that after hearing any of my stories. But at a reading that I first gave when I came to San Francisco, I had read Anyway, one of the stories, and I had thought that I had established rapport. Apparently, I hadn't, because I was questioned very closely by several very sharp-witted young men as to what did I mean by several of these characters, that what was I thinking about when I introduced them into the story, etc. So just to clarify, these people are people that I have known and that I have been involved with. This I use something I seldom try to do, but I somehow or another I got around to trying to introduce a little imagination into the thing. So one or two instances which you'll recognize are, of course, slightly imaginary. But at any rate, winds are still, heat hangs heavy and oppressive, low gray clouds illuminated by the lights of the city seemingly glow in the night sky. A dog howls somewhere the next block over. The night is haunted. September demons chitter and chatter. Stair steps creak and moan with weight of evil forces ascending six flights up to gain entrance to the three rooms of my dwelling. Each room contains individual shadows teeming with the spawn of black magic. The purple taper burns a flickering flame, casting unsteady light. My nerve ends are exposed and raw. Each minute sound sends waves of sticky warmth through my being. I am sure the magician approaches. He has planned the instant of unleashing his power be drenched in blood, and he has selected me to release the flow. I did reject and receive vitriol, and he placed symbols required to fill my heart with sharp pain. He cried fool, accusing me of benevolence, then whispered the pit-black words rich with magic force, appointing me his executioner. I did not understand his interest in me when first he began giving me freely of the crystal clear elixir, and I was as one reborn. I listened to his flute voice rise in early dawn light, he alone, and I allowed to walk by his side. This in early spring, the morning stirring with gentle, faintly warm wind, while the city around us began discarding the drab, soot-polluted winter colors, replacing them with bright blue, red, yellow, and all the gay pastels of spring. I but realized his magical capabilities. He began revealing himself in the role of a lover, selecting a fine, beautiful young woman I also loved to create beautiful magic truths for and asking her to share his search for truth. At the start, gentle, patient, kind, carefully explaining the complexities, demanding only truth from her but not always believing. Still in the beginning, he would listen and understand and approve and smile and speak in detail to great length about beauty, purity, white magic. Then as he watched her belief strengthen, grow, accept, learn her strength, observe the completeness of her innocence, he sensed the depth of his evilness and became frightened, feeling confident much of evil within himself must be matched in others, and she surely must contain her share, and besides all honey and no spice, who in hell did she think she could kid? So gradually he began releasing his black power, finally calling her ugly, a liar, a dirty, selfish bitch, resorting in his frustration to absorb entirely her true essence of beauty, to slapping, pinching, kicking, stealing her food, very nearly chaining her to his side, never permitting her to leave his presence, screaming foul names, hating her because she retained her greatness, and more so because he began losing his as he revealed his insecurity, his smallness and inability to exist independently of her or anyone else he might fortunately have drawn to his orbit. His potential as a magician, a creator, became less until even his loyalist followers began turning their backs, shutting their doors, hardly interested in his continued existence. He decided on extinction, annihilation, suicide. His plan was to have himself killed, cause as much dissension, confusion, and general discomfort as possible. I had followed closely his relationship with our mutual love, seldom making even a vague effort to interfere. She kept me informed of her feelings at all times, and I felt quite certain she deserved the respect of being allowed to decide for herself when or if ever she desired leaving him. He had woven magnificent and intricately created magic worlds for her private observation. She had witnessed complete opposites of the same truth and knew it to retain the same truth. New and greater depths of reality became hers, and she learned the world filled with magic. His beauty and creative ability had been so fine, When he began changing, she was unable to accept the change as coming from him, believing instead herself to be at fault. It was when he became increasingly violent, her first doubts about his greatness took root. Up to the point where it was impossible to be in their presence when they weren't bickering, he making accusations, she on the defensive, he threatening, screaming names at her, nymphomaniac, whore, cunt, sex freak, striking out at her, she flinching any time he moved toward her, I had stayed clear except to try and reason, and on a few occasions hold on to him in an effort to keep him from hitting her again. I am something of a coward, and short of stark tragedy, I couldn't see any way of breaking up their relationship. Also, a number of other considerations were at this time not to be ignored. Nevertheless, I did decide at the first chance I'd get her away long enough to break the chain of thought, giving her an opportunity to obtain an accelerated, varied change process in order to accomplish so radical a break in the pattern. Considerable functioning on principle of being on the alert was required. The moment propitious to leave, depart, scram, split, take off. And it arrived 2:00 one morning. Returning from a walk on moon-drenched, ruby-red stoplights lined intermittently Avenue C, the city lived almost in crystal brightness. Opening the door of the apartment, my glance became arrested on her beauty. She's sitting cross-legged on a huge square, four-peopled mattress, a low flat appearing somewhat functional table made of three drawers, one on top to a desk. There's something here. But anyway, the several other units used satisfactorily elsewhere. A gray, beige, black, shades of black, demon-shaped, African-figured patterns, seeming at first glance devoid of any consistency or relationship. An early magical creation from the organic inks, iodines, violets. One of his early possessions was used as a spread. She was stretching forward a tiny Japanese brush stained black purple toward a small crock or jug. She looked at me intently a moment, slightly bent forward, her long gold-brown hair hanging over the sides of her face. She suddenly laughed, rocked gently over to the side, dipped the brush, and straightened up, making calligraphic symbols on a large piece of oatmeal paper. Again, stopping abruptly, she looked directly into my face, asking, "Are you happy? Is everything all right? Have I spoken harshly or in anger to you? You must never worry or brood about my appearing angry. It can't happen with you." And she started her painstaking calligraphy again. Vivaldi's The Seasons was on the phonograph, tuned to a fine, rich medium. My big black cat came in through the fire escape balcony window, stirring with his sweep of tail the Chinese wind glass. A wave of alert perception filled each of us with smiles. The whole thing was funny, ringing, tingling. The waves of activity, opening doors and walking across the room, rustling papers, and no sound from the magician. He had had a busy day, everyone wanting curses. There were these, and now there is none. And it came about I arranged the first rift between them. He slept while I abducted her, encouraged her to see as I saw. Still, she remained reluctant to leave him without explaining why she was leaving. This would have created an additional confusion at that point to be avoided. She was finally persuaded against her will to attempt a short trip out into the country. I felt considerably relieved about the danger threatening her, but was somewhat skeptical of how he could make the adjustment. His rages of anger and perplexity were intermingled so completely, I began immediately feeling confident of his basic goodness. Almost sure the evidences of evil I had observed were my own projections. He was extremely humble and began declaring his love for her to everyone. His promises of how he would work only for a future happiness of us all were many and profuse. Life was unthinkable without her. He had done great things in the beginning and would be even greater in the future. He had to have her by his side. And she returned quickly, more radiant and beautiful than I had ever known her, anxious to forget past behavior and begin working toward a world of miracles, a world filled with magic. Her eyes had been opened, and as he began slipping back into his demonic habits, she was aware and began rebuffing him, until he became desperate and again raised his hands, stamping his feet, snarling and glaring, screaming and threatening. Their lives filled with dissension, and although he called on all his powers, they failed him. He could not submerge her beauty nor detract from her basic innocence. Soon she began observing new people more intently, taking in the scene. He could use all his tricks. He would never again be able to convince her of anything unless she wanted to believe. Still, he retained one powerful hold. She was learning magic, and there were many symbols he could teach her. He became amazingly ugly in appearance, his smile false, his voice hollow and empty. He was always moving around, never still. He'd always been a thief, nothing big, small things, preferably with sentimental value to the owner. One couldn't take him visiting. He was sure to take things. At this point, not only was he stealing, but he became possessive about things he wanted personally, accusing everyone of what he himself was guilty of. He became a living embodiment of contradictions. He was desperate. It was much too late. He lost completely what influence he had built up, and there was no possibility of establishing anything worthwhile. It was about this time he hit upon the idea of having me kill him. He wanted death, and what better way to bring it about than to have me cause it? I had never tangled with him physically, other than a brief skirmish, and he knew it would require a great deal of agitation to cause me to become violent. But, and this is important, he also knew, brought to the point of violence, I would have practically no control. All I would need would be a knife. She has been away the last few days, and he has been wandering the streets. He is rather to be pitied. Now he slowly climbs the stairs, seeking the end. I have half decided to do it. He'll knock. I'll ask who it is. He'll reply at the same time, demanding I open the door. I can open the door, stick him, and it will be done. But this is really too final. I think I have something better, something he will live with the rest of his life. He'll have to find someone else for his dirty work. I have in my hand an eyedropper filled with a slow-acting poison and a hypodermic needle specially dipped in a germ-infested solution containing the hepatitis bug. Meanwhile, the girl and I have recently planned we can sail on the Scandinavian ships together. She can become a stewardess, and I can take anything. It sounds great. I'll open the door. I'm calm and ready. He isn't sure of what to expect. I can see him as he turns on the last step. His eyes are dull and glazed. His hair stands on end. His clothes are filthy. He is tired. He tries to appear sinister. In one hand, he carries a flute, and in the other, his book of symbols. As he comes closer, he begins pleading with his eyes for anything. It doesn't matter what, death, an hour's rest, a change of clothing. I open the door wide. The candle flame dances wildly for a moment, caught in the draft. He enters, and as he turns to look around, I plunge the needle into his flesh. His eyes fill with horror. He tries to struggle, but I have already thrown a headlock on him. Also, the dropper is almost empty. It is over, and he sits staring into space. He has cursed me with any curse and all curses. We are laughing because we neither one of us, she and I, exist in a reality. We are figments of his imagination. And anyway, his imagination has had it. We are moving on to new environment. There will be no more black magic from him. He is finished. Already he turns saffron. I can hear the boat whistles from where I live. On a foggy morning, they seemingly call to each other ceaselessly. Some are near and loud and strident. Others pick up the call until finally off in the distance, there's only a faint tone barely heard. Sometimes they sound simultaneous. Simultaneously, one can pick out the riverboat, the tug, the ocean-going steamers, little boats all talking to each other, helping create the opening music of a New York morning. The whistles are silent tonight. And that's the magician. This is recent and hasn't been published. Maybe never will be, I don't know. Let's see. I don't know how much you people know about me as a person, my habits and so forth. I'm a drug addict, or have been a drug addict all my life. The last year, I... Made several attempts to withdraw. I physically, it was accomplished, but you know. Anyway, each time I went into the same hospital, the Manhattan General, which has a program set up for drug addicts, they give you a methadone withdrawal treatment, which is pretty effective. It's good, as a matter of fact. Anyway, the whole setup is really kind of amusing, and I got so I enjoyed going. Anyway, here goes. I've written a couple of stories. I got a couple of stories out of it, and this was the last story. It's called Joseph Martinez. Joseph Martinez is a 24-year-old man from Brooklyn who was born in Puerto Rico. He is a drug addict and a thief. He is proud and full of vitality and a sensitive and fully wide-awake young man. Recently, while in the hospital, we met and became good friends. We first saw each other in the waiting room of the hospital on the morning of our admittance. We looked at each other and flirted a little with our eyes, but we didn't speak to each other or become acquainted until later, when we were upstairs and settled down to our daily routine and started on our withdrawal program. We were waiting in line to pick up our last methadone shot the first day, and I had been in line ahead of him, and after stepping up to the nurse's station and taking my shot, I use the word shot very loosely, since what I mean is I drank a small glass of methadone, supposedly 15 milligrams. As I turned away, I looked directly into his eyes. He was three men behind me in the line, and still looking at each other, I began easing past the men, including him, who were up close to the window, and passing him, he spoke to me. How you doing? Do you feel bad? What room are you in? I'll stop by as soon as I've copped, and we can wrap until time for sleeping medication. I told him my room number and said, boss, baby, I'll expect you. I'm doing okay, but it sure would be great to hit the cooker about now. We both laughed, and I continued onto my room, where I stretched out on my bed and waited for him to show. My mind was full of curiosity and speculation. I had just started comparing him in my thoughts with Whitey when he came into the room, big smile on his face and holding a couple of candy bars in his hand. He walked up and sat down on the edge of the bed, sort of proffering one of the candy bars toward me. He said, you dig candy when you kick? I do, man. I can do up some candy when I kick. You look better already. Man, when I saw you downstairs, you look wasted. What's that rash on your face? You take bombitas? My name is Joe. In Spanish, it is pronounced Jose. My full name is Jose Martinez. I liked him. There was something at once physical and alive and of the essence of living and of energy and soul. His eyes were full of light and expression, communicating constantly, and I imagined I could detect a glimmer of love, and I opened up to him a little, and soon we began to know each other. And he began telling me stories of his life, of his first love, and he told it with feeling and sincerity. Supposedly, she was 10 when he first made an approach toward her, and he had been 14. He spoke of her in tones of tenderness and always with a certain awareness of her physical being. It was almost a classic, or the classic-type romantic love story of the shy and poor young Puerto Rican, mountain boy in the city alone and defensive, part of the scene, yet sure to prove his worth only when he could eventually fall by in his convertible, draped in a fine suit and wearing a neat, sharp tie with one of those English collars, the very latest in style, and a boss hat. The rim snapped down in front, sort of tilted a bit over one eye, really looking good and a pocket full of money. And then her parents wouldn't object to him anymore or interfere with their seeing each other, and of her having to put down the man her family forced her into marrying. And, of course, she respects her husband, but her heart is for Joey. He says, me, Joey Martinez. I'd show everybody, hunky. Everybody would see how sharp I am and not bad. I'd even go back to her church, although I've had a chance to see that's full of shit. Also, hypocritical, and I don't believe in their kind of God, if I believe in any anyway. Her priest sold out to her old man because he kicks in steadily to the pot, buys, tends the church functions. Naturally, he could pat me on the back and tell me he understood and he'd speak to her parents and did, but not helpfully, and agreed with her father it would be wiser to send his daughter back home to the island, to Puerto Rico, for a while. There were some wild scenes and one hunky where I'd called them all punk motherfuckers, and I held myself up tight to keep them smashing something over their heads, a chair. Even the priest, who kept trying to call me, not even letting me talk, and her punk father pulled her out away from me, telling her I was a no-good junkie, a hoodlum, hanging around corners, probably not out sticking people up, taking their money and using it to buy filthy dope to shoot into my arm, nodding and full of that stuff, and I'd always be no good and should be in jail. We had talked about my quitting for good, and I'd almost made her the promise I'd stop if we could only go on seeing each other and her family wouldn't interfere, And we'd gone to this church affair just to speak to her mother and father and ask them to let us see each other. And I'd get a job. Maybe he could help me. And all hell broke loose when they saw me walk through the door. It hurt me so much, all I wanted to do was to kill somebody. And I don't like to hurt people. I don't like fights, and baby, I can fight. Finally, a cop came in who knows me, and he calmed me down, and he took me out with him and bought me a few shots at the bar, talking to me, telling me he saw things my way, and they were all full of crap, but I should remember nothing was worth going through all that kind of thing for in the church, and I should wait, and maybe after all I'd lost my crazy feelings, I should try and see her again and then talk to her people. I fucked everybody. I left him and went out and saw some friends who turned me on and gave me 60 bags on consignment, and I became a dealer. I made a lot of money. I had listened intently and watched him, his movements, the hand gestures, the lifting of the head, the fierce expression in the eye when he had spoken of defending himself, and the sly twinkle when he had spoken at some point where he had gotten the upper hand, or when he had involved some scheme, in his slightly boastful time when he had been clever, or when someone else had pulled a cutie. I had known all along, even though he was telling me a tragic experience and recognized all the fine points, he never failed to retain his sense of humor. I was pretty sure while he was enlightening me about himself, he was still very aware of me, and not a word or gesture of mine had gone unnoticed. We became fairly steady companions and made a sort of comrade-like love scene, full of a sort of promise of becoming even more intense in the future. Frankly, I was attracted by the idea, but I wasn't at all sure I wanted things to take that turn between us. Joey wasn't Whitey. He had much the same interest, but he wasn't as full of guile as Whitey and could be hurt easier than Whitey simply because he was already aware of loneliness in the manner Whitey had never been and therefore was more honest about his feelings. He made me happy with his charm and brightness, and I only wish I could have done some beautiful thing for him. Instead, I signed out, leaving him behind to remain for the medical discharge in order to meet the demands of his parole officer and fulfill the required behavior pattern. Also, he would receive welfare assistance. He didn't want me to split, and I had to be unkind, but I realized there's nothing sensible about permitting further development between us. I always fail to understand the vast differences in age. I am no longer always hip to the immediate happening, since many things enter the scene surrounding youth that simply are new, and although I'm alert to the attractions, it is one I've never experienced, and so it is inevitable we part. He has asked me to meet him the morning of his release, and I'm attracted to the plan, but it still would depend on many things, and I must wait and see. He would sometimes brag and point out about his good looks, his form, his coloring, and his great smile. One thing he did tell me makes him very special. He had been speaking at length of his neighborhood, his junk habits, and he told me of a couple of his capers and of the money and how he'd spent it, and also of how he felt he was thought of in his neighborhood. And he'd been very open, showing no embarrassment at some of the revelations he at the same time thought needed qualifying. And we were strolling down the corridor toward the nurse's station for the final medication of that day, and he suddenly began telling me of a dream and of what message the dream had given him. And looking at me, he said, "Nothing bad will ever happen to me because someone looks over me and takes care of me." And I asked him who he thought it was, and he answered, "My guardian angel." That's it. I wrote this morning about, I don't know what time it was, about 3 o'clock in the morning, I guess. Not very much. Let's see how it sounds. Tuesday, February 7th, 1967. Again, morning early in a whole new confusion and muddledness, and my feelings about even trying to look toward the next 10 hours, much less thinking about the future. Janine angry, not feeling good, wishing to escape her demons and everything, her unhappy memories, her state of being entirely alone, and me, maybe not me completely, but at least to have a spot of her own. She said something to me earlier in the night about too much traffic, people in and out, and I replied, and we argued, and I raised my voice loudly, and tension mounted, and I said unkind things, and now our feelings and conduct are different, and our love for each other is strained. Serge has departed and perhaps won't return. I have been yelled at and screamed at, sneered at and pitied. I've been patiently tolerated and violently told to leave others alone. Everything is valid with everyone at different points of separation. It is sad. Either I am mad or without the ordinary decency of self-respect sufficiently to stop acting the role of the fool. What in the hell is it I am striving to attain with anyone or any place? I simply begin enjoying myself, responding to people, forgetting problems to the extent of not dwelling on them, relaxing and doing whatever I feel like doing at the moment, and constantly talking. A comment and gossip and philosophical observations and ceaselessly droning on and on to everyone, but particularly to those closest to me, inwardly knowing without concern for possibly being mistaken, everything is accepted for granted, as I've said it. I am invariably astounded when learning suddenly what I meant wasn't even close to the way it has been understood. I am quite willing to believe half of what has transpired at the period could be misinterpreted, audibly unheard, but it remains incredible sometimes to discover nothing at all that I've got through. When this type of situation develops and thinking about it, it is amazing to discover the frequency of occurrence. I feel a despair and weariness to intense rushes of emptiness and defeat. I immediately begin behaving in thoroughly stupid outbursts of lost reason, inarticulateness, and screaming waves of vulgar and anger-ridden laments of self-pity-induced defense. At the instance of this writing, my affairs are seemingly about ready to plunge into a state of hopeless chaos, futility, back to wishing for death and living because I'm not dead only, without joy or hope or love and caught in the trap of shame, again having been vulnerable to a well-applied sales campaign for a first-class mark, a patsy, a chump, and a grade-A sucker. In bringing this to a close, I'd at least save face, if able to say, finally, Janine and I have regained peace between us, and Serge is trying to see the possibility of our remaining friends and has promised to exert more effort toward understanding. There isn't anything very bad about liking someone, and all the feelings of painful humiliation and self-dislike have come about through a slight misunderstanding and didn't mean Serge was only motivated by a desire for amusement, and I cooperated by going overboard for a well-delivered line of sweet talk, as I secretly and up until a moment ago absolutely believed. Serge has come back as he said he would and has taken care of the business in hand, apparently with efficiency and satisfactory service. All goes well, and my soul once again ascends toward the universe of energy and away from the black cave, burial ground and death eternal land of oblivion. And we are still together, Janine, Serge, and me. This, I think, should just about do it. It's called The Sea Voyage. Phil awakened me early in the morning. Apparently, Bozo let him in, pulling the bedclothes off of me and exposing me to a biting cold draft from the open window. Bob and I had shared the studio couch in the front room, and we had drawn together during the night to keep warm, and I had wrapped my arms around him, something that I had secretly wanted to do, and it was with added reluctance I greeted Phil, who stood hovering over the couch, sort of clucking with a widespread leer on his face. It was from a pleasant drowsiness and peaceful dream I awakened into the nightmare morning. A cold, chilling wind widened outside the windows, and the sky was overladen with gray clouds. Cold city sounds carried up from the streets, and there was nothing I wanted quite so much as to remain in bed. Kay and Phil had recently been quarreling, Kay complaining about Phil's habit and pleading with him to try to kick, and finally suggesting that he and I get a job aboard a ship together so that we both might kick. Phil, in order to restore peace, and partly through feelings of guilt and frustration, was one round and spent the preceding day convincing me the idea was sensible. It wasn't that either of us were anxious to kick, but rather the conditions we were surrounded by had forced us to seek a means of escape. We both had obtained our seaman papers at about the same time, but had never made a trip together. In some respects, the plan was appealing. At any rate, he was now standing over me, insisting I get up so that we could go down to the ship companies for jobs. Bozo was wandering around the kitchen preparing coffee while making little snide remarks about my general indifference to the more practical aspects of life. Bob had promptly rolled over, pulling the blankets up around his ears and mumbling to the effect he wished we'd get the hell out so he could go back to sleep. And so I got up. I had saved a little fix, and after getting straight and dressed while Phil and Bozo sat gossiping about what a dear, fine female Kay was and how understanding, after all, there were really few respectable women willing to put up with a junkie, and at least in Bozo's opinion, Phil should be grateful. Kay was actually a vampire and eventually drained Phil. We finally got started and went directly down to a company sending out tankers and were assigned to a ship bound for Honolulu. Phil was signed on as a ship's messman and I took utility man in the galley. The man out of the corner of his mouth had told us the ship's a hot ship, meaning that it was scheduled to sail almost immediately, which was good since by this time both of us were anxious to get away as quickly as possible. We sailed from New Jersey early the following morning. We had rushed around New York all the preceding day, first making a connection. This was to be a slow withdrawal cure. Then saying goodbye to acquaintances and friends, making arrangements to have our few possessions taken care of while gone, and a special farewell with Kay. We sailed in a blinding snowstorm. We had been the last to sign aboard and received what was left of the sleeping quarters. Our forecastle was large enough to accommodate two more. And for some reason I never discovered, we remained alone, and it was situated at the aft end of the ship. It was comfortable, and we succeeded in unconsciously turning it into what the captain later suggested looked like an opium den. Phil immediately climbed into his bunk, staying there for 2 days, causing the steward to become almost sick with anxiety and to bombard me, who, having provided myself with a good supply of Benzedrine, was busy performing my required tasks with what to the steward was amazing vigor with all sorts of questions. He found it difficult to understand what could possibly be ailing Phil and was somewhat hesitant of accepting my explanation to the effect he's been drinking heavily for the past few weeks. But don't worry, man, he'll come around, give him time. To which the steward replied, I know, but the same can be said for the most of the crew, and they're up and working. The ship was an old ship, having hit the sea about 1915, and in the rough seas creaked and groaned. It had been making the same run for many years, and it wasn't until we entered the Caribbean that it settled down. The trip down the Atlantic coast was uneventful, except that en route we gathered several hundred birds. We would awaken in the morning, and there they were, roosting all over the ship. And when we began reaching the area off the Florida coast, they began departing. By the time we passed through Windward Passage, most of them were gone. I don't know what kind of birds they were, although I did recognize an owl, which was almost the last to leave. But I was much impressed by them, and they were the first of a series of natural phenomena to fill me with awe and wonder throughout the entire voyage. The crew was an interesting group of old-time seamen, the kind that one sees hanging around the bars on South Street, along the waterfront in New York, in the Seamen's Institute, or sitting around in groups, passing a bottle of wine among themselves, and looking like typical bums. Not one of them had ever been to a maritime school, and Kings Point was only a name as far as they were concerned. They had learned the hard way through experience. One old deckhand had been around the world 18 times and could tell stories about every port he'd been in. They were a rugged lot, filled with a sense of the joy of living I've never encountered in any similar group. And they were all friends, and many had sailed together for a long period of time. Phil and I were rather outsiders, and it took a while before they accepted us into their confidence. Phil was more successful than I in making friends with them, and when he finally came out of his 2 days' sleep, it was no time until he knew practically everybody. The captain was an old Dutchman, burly and gruff, who stayed much to himself in his own quarters. The only time I heard him speak was after he'd received a report from the steward. This happened outside Aruba as we were leaving on our way toward Panama. that I had refused to do some to sort some old rotten potatoes, suggesting that if the steward wanted it done, he'd do it himself, and besides, it wasn't my job, and that he didn't know what to do about Phil and me. We were good workers, but inclined to do as we pleased. The captain had come to our forecastle, and after looking around, said, "God damn, this looks like an opium den. You guys hopheads?" This was said in a heavy guttural accent. We both assured him such was not the case, and he left telling us, "Try and get along with the steward, who was a damn fool." We had had an exceptionally fine time in Aruba. As a matter of fact, the captain was closer to the truth than he knew, since while in Aruba, we had picked up on yenpak, opium ash, and had stayed knocked out the whole time we were there. And by knocked out, I mean high. Aruba is a small island, very tropical as to climate. We had not been there an hour when out of a clear blue sky, a sudden cloud appeared and unleashed a deluge of rain, which lasted a short time and then disappeared, leaving once again a blue and gold day. The rain evaporated quickly and everything was left dry. The people of Aruba are a mixture of light and dark and all very beautiful. There are several nationalities, and it was from a Chinaman we had obtained the yen pot. Phil became involved with a little dark-skinned girl who, after they had balled, kept trailing him around, begging him to stay. We stayed 3 days. It was while sailing to the Caribbean Sea I first became aware of how insignificant I am in comparison to the vastness of the universe. The sea all day remains a magnificent, sparkling surface of blue, deep indigo, undulating in long, rolling swells. Schools of spangled blue flying fish skim the top. Porpoises race and leap in constant play. And at night, the sky overhead is either a vast expanse of stars, some of which streak across space in splendid motion, which when beheld quicken the heart, or it is blanketed with great heavy clouds, black and rolling, lit from above with ceaseless flashing lightning, while the sea glitters with balls of tossing phosphorus light. The air is warm and scented with the odor from the distant jungles. And one has a sense of the concentration of energy and sizzling, crackling electrical force which seemed to almost be waiting to tear the whole universe asunder. It was on such a night, and we were steaming steadily toward Koh Lan, that Phil and I and myself, along with two others, one, a fellow who shortly after we became acquainted had produced a cigar box full of pot, so that we had been smoking pot for the entire trip thus far, and the other, who had eyes for Phil and had been wooing him by stealing morphine syrettes from the lifeboats, presenting them to him and beseeching him to have a ball, were sitting and lying on the aft end of the ship, watching the wake and exclaiming about the night and laughing and sometimes singing. The gay boy had been pressing Phil to go below with him and making various remarks full of suggestive sexual connotation, finally capping himself when he suddenly exclaimed, while observing a large, almost perfectly round puff of black smoke which had been emitted from the ship's funnel and was hanging nearly motionless overhead, "Oh, look, it's just like a big dinged nut." We arrived in Koh Lan and were given immediate shore leave. Phil and I lost no time in searching out the native section and were successful in obtaining cocaine and undoubtedly the finest pot I have ever smoked. The man who helped us make the connection was really a cat. He was tall and very dark-skinned, dressed in a delicate pink shirt, light, almost white-colored slacks, with a large-brimmed Panama straw hat, with a brilliant red band and sandals. He moved with truly feline grace and spoke softly through shiny white teeth. Phil had left me standing in front of a pharmacia, the whole storefront open to the street, while he was inside with the proprietor, wildly searching the shelves, looking for anything remotely resembling junk. And I had become interested in two children who were playing some kind of game when he appeared at my side and said, "Hi, Mon, my name is Victor. You want to get straight?" He led me down a street, unpaved, and with the houses all sitting back from the walk and wide open so that I could see into them and their occupants and what they were doing. It was a still hot tropical night, and pervading the whole street was the aroma of burning pot. Several young girls with high breasts and tight dresses passed us, giggling and swinging their hips and flashing big smiles at Victor, who pretended not to notice. Kerosene lamps and candles shed the only light except that of the night overhead, and the scent of lilies blended with and perfumed the pot smoke. Suddenly, Victor halted and said, "Wait here, Mon," and disappeared. I stood there in wonder and delight. He returned soon and laid a long package the length of a sheet torn from a Saturday Evening Post, And Big Round is a half dollar full of pot in my hands. And then said, "You want cocaine?" I get. I said yes, and once again I was alone. As before, he returned quickly. I gave him the money, something like $10 or $12, and laden with two nights of cocaine and a month of pot, returned to where Phil, who had settled for a hypodermic needle and pockets full of Nembutal, Secondol, and Amitrol, was waiting. We said goodbye to Victor and started back toward the docks to catch the launch out to the ship, which lay anchored out in the bay. En route, we bought a small white-faced monkey from a boy who had him on a long chain and had been teasing him with a stick, causing him to screech and jump. We kept him in our forecastle, where he occupied the section set aside for the other two men. I took one of the bunk springs and set it on end facing the bulkhead, and he slept on top and would climb up and down the spring. He was comparatively clean in that he pissed and shit pretty much in one spot, most of the time on newspapers, which I spread over in his section. He had the run of the forecastle and took over. When he was pleased or content, or after having been fed something he liked, grapes were his favorite dish, he would chitter and show his teeth. But when annoyed or angry, especially if scolded, would set up a din of screeching which would chill one to the bone. The trip through the locks was interesting. We stopped in Balboa for a short time, but not long enough for shore leave, and then out into the Pacific Ocean. Life aboard ship had settled down to a more or less even routine. We were making it on Benzedrine, Nembutal, Secondol, and Amitrol, and a fairly steady supply of morphine, cigarettes, and pot. Jocko, the monkey, took to pot like the proverbial duck to water, and as soon as I would light up, would jump up on my shoulder, and I would exhale the smoke into his little grimming face. He and I would get high, and he would balance himself on the rail while I leaned up against it and looked at the sea. He would talk to me in little chittering sounds, and I would tell him about how cute and how great I thought he was. One day we saw a huge fish leap out of the sea and plunge back in again. The sea was a molten gray mass with a veil of shimmering vapor hanging just above the surface, reflecting the burning sun. And when suddenly it seemed almost to shatter, this huge fish, glistening in the light, seemingly exploded into the air for a moment amidst a spray of crystal drops of water, arched, and slid back into the sea. We were both surprised. Jocko actually screeched, and I almost yelled to him, "Did you dig that?" Phil had decided to augment his finances by playing poker, and at this time spent much of his free time practicing how to stack the deck. I don't remember him being very competent at it, but at any rate, he didn't lose. The games would occasionally last all night and continued until we reached Honolulu. We didn't spend enough time in Honolulu for me to absorb much of an impression of it. I recall several bars of nondescript nature where we drank rum, a small amusement park, Dole's Pineapple, palm trees, hundreds of soldiers and sailors, the YMCA, where I mailed a postcard to someone, clean streets, high prices, tapa cloth, which I like, and of course the beach and the glass clear water and its turquoise blue color. Also, we were completely unsuccessful as to pont or junk, although we did make a drugstore for a fresh supply of Benzedrine. I must admit that what little I saw of the islands from the ship was beautiful, and I might like going back sometime. Unfortunately, everything is too Americanized and concerned with tourists. We returned by the same route, and just before getting back to Balboa, it was time for the full moon, and for several nights I lay on deck, moonstruck. We sailed in a long silver lane. Everything lay revealed in the light of the moon and wore a glowing aura, mysterious to the night, and became new, retaining but little relationship to what it was in the brightness of the sun. Everything was bathed in opalescence. The night became a sort of day, strange and weird, as if in another planet or world. Once again, we anchored at Balboa. We picked up supplies, bananas, oranges, green stuff, grapes, and some staples, and then on back through the canal to Colon, where we sailed past while I stood on deck with Jocko, sending telepathic messages to Victor, telling him I would never forget him and that I'd try and make that scene again sometime. Please remember me. We continued on through the Caribbean, celebrating the New Year with beer and ice cream, and back up past the Florida coast after catching a glimpse of Haiti and the Atlantic coast, minus birds and Chesapeake Bay or Newport News, and at the end of the voyage. I left Jocko aboard the ship with one of the crew members who was signing back on and who promised me he would try and set him free or at least see to it he got a good home, maybe in Aruba or even Colon. I would have liked keeping him, but it would have been cruel of me to bring him to New York. The weather was exceedingly cold as well, and Jocko belonged to the tropics. I could have smuggled him ashore without any trouble. Phil and I, after we were paid off, took the train for New York and could hardly wait to make our first connection. Junk-wise, the trip had been great. Habit-kicking-wise, a complete failure. But then neither one of us, as I said before, really wanted to kick. Bozo was still wandering back and forth between Creedmoor, where he had a job as an attendant, and the apartment, bickering and fretting. Bob had gotten himself involved in some big, vague scheme and was rushing around in a Benzedrine whirl. Kay could hardly wait to sink her teeth into Phil. Phil left me in front of the apartment after we had made arrangements for a meet the following day, and I went upstairs and rolled up the last of that fine Panamanian pot, flopped down and got stoned, thinking about Jocko, Victor, the Caribbean Sea, and the whole trip. Okay. I don't think we have time for any more. I've read 10 minutes overtime now, you know. Thanks. Oh, incidentally, is Mrs. Black here anywhere? Polly Black? No. Oh, that's a draft.